Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Obama's on top. Nowhere to go but down.
One's title, even a title like President of the United States, says very little about how well one's life has been led. That no matter how much you've done or how successful you've been, there's always more to do, always more to learn, and always more to achieve.
Give it a rest, Mr. President. Mr. Achievement himself speaks to graduates at Arizona State University commencing the brave new world when the economy stomps on your circumstances. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. We're pumped up on pomp and circumstances in honor of the 2009 grads. It's Thursday, May 14th. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, we do the math on the economic stimulus so far. Is this the beginning of a new era of military cooperation with Pakistan regarding robot drone airplanes? Also, the woes of being a Chrysler dealer these days. New dealership closures are expected this week. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines. And in the headlines, the Obama administration is expected to announce additions to its mortgage plan today. Homeowners take notice. The new measures offer more assistance for homeowners. Borrowers may be able to avoid foreclosure by selling their properties or returning them to lenders. Meanwhile, the president will hold a town hall style meeting in Albuquerque, New Mexico today. It's with people who've written the White House about their frustrations with credit card companies. He's pushing a measure aimed at ending hidden fees and sudden interest rate hikes. Femi Oke is here with some more headlines. Good morning, Femi.
Hello there, John. Good morning, all. Pope Benedict is in Nazareth today, celebrating a huge outdoor mass with thousands of Christians.
Nazareth has experienced tensions in recent years which have harmed relations between its Christian and Muslim communities.
The Pope's week-long trip through the Middle East is meant to improve relationships between Christians and Muslims. In Sri Lanka, at least 2,000 ethnic Tamil civilians braved rebel fire and waded across a lagoon today to break out of the war zone. This comes as both sides pressed ahead with fighting despite international appeals to stop. A bill to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan through September comes up for a House vote today. The nearly $97 billion measure does not include the $80 million the administration requested to close Guantanamo Bay.
North Korea has set a trial date for two American journalists accused of entering the country illegally. They'll be tried on June 4th for what North Korea describes as hostile acts. The journalists were detained near the Chinese border in March while researching a story about North Korean refugees. A couple of big economic indicators due out later this morning. We learned the number of jobless claims from last week, as well as last month's producer price index. Japanese electronics giant Sony announced an annual loss of $1 billion today. That's its first net loss in 14 years. And it turned every Asian market down. This morning, key indices in Japan and Hong Kong down around 3%. Tough day on Wall Street yesterday. Dow and S&P fell both more than 2%. The S&P finishes trading at 884 yesterday, which is where it begins today. We're watching the futures, a flat opening expected. We'll be hearing more about one of the most memorable commencement speeches that began as a newspaper column. You may remember it. It had to do with sunscreen. But we're looking for advice for the class of 2009. Give it, won't you? Step up to the mic. Give a commencement speech at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. We begin with economics today. We often do these days. But evaluating the 787 $1 billion economic stimulus package is actually a difficult task, partly because of the scale and partly because of the politics involved. For instance, in his first quarterly report to the president released yesterday, Vice President Joe Biden, who you may remember is actually in charge of implementing the stimulus package, gave the Obama administration an A+. Maybe it's not a huge surprise. The report says that immediate financial relief has gone to Americans and billions of dollars has gone into job-creating projects. But evaluating the stimulus package is something of a numbers racket and something of a confidence game as well. The psychological meters of the marketplace and the economy are probably as important as some of the numbers here. And with two views of how we would evaluate this stimulus package and what needs to be done next, joining us are Simon Johnson, former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. He's a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, co-founder of the Baseline Scenario blog, and writes for the economics blog at nytimes.com. And also joining us is Andrea Bernstein, our friend, takeaway correspondent, and director of our Shovel Watch project. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Andrea, let me begin with you. If we evaluate this on the basis of numbers, where do we begin?
Oh, geez. Well, you know, it's sort of like this particular report, this first quarterly report, you know, on sort of the PR meter, it's really going into the red. Everything is used to really say, wow, this is great. Now, you know, we can ask our economist friend in a second. I'm not an economist. And I do know, as the more I learn about
I assure you, Simon will have plenty to say. Yes.
of economy. You know, I realize that part of it is making people feel happy because when they feel happy, they'll go out and buy stuff.
Well, but the percentages here are kind of alarming. I was looking at some of the numbers yesterday. How much has been spent?
6% has actually been spent in the States.
Feels
and,
small.
Right. So, I mean, when you look at this gushing report, I mean, you'll find things like $88 billion have been obligated. Well, you know, that's Washington speak. That means that, yes, we've promised we'll spend that. It doesn't mean it's actually gone out into jobs. I mean, you know, the tax cuts, Biden says, well, they started to go into effect within weeks. Well, yeah, within 6 weeks, which, you know, isn't normally what you think. But the money is getting out there slowly, and you know, every poll says that people are feeling a little better, and you know, I found that on the streets. That is important, but you know, in terms of actual jobs created or saved, this report acknowledges that, you know, the numbers on that, the direct jobs created, are not measurable at this point. They're just beginning to ask the states to do that. But they are sticking by their estimate of 150,000 jobs created or saved in the first 100 days of the administration. And they're now saying there's going to be 600,000 jobs in the next 100 days. So, you know, they're giving themselves a great report card, patting themselves on the back. I was actually speaking last night with the vice president's office trying to find out which sectors these 100,000 jobs have been created or saved in. And other than, you know, state governments not having to fire people, because this is what a lot of the money went for.
So it's a little fuzzy.
They're still not saying. Yeah. So, we'll get back to you on that.
All right. Well, Simon, if we look at the confidence meter here, there are some signs in the credit markets particularly that things have begun to turn around.
Absolutely. I think actually Joe Biden's team is being somewhat modest. I'm a critic of the administration on many points, don't get me wrong. But I think the fiscal stimulus has really helped to restore confidence in the credit markets. Now, that confidence is precarious. You can undermine it. If you really mess up down the road. But I think we may have turned the corner on the crisis, which is really quite an achievement.
Economically speaking, though, Simon, is this like for a 6% down payment, we've gotten $787 billion of bang for our economic policy?
Yes, it is, actually. And the key thing is that, you
know,
it's all in the works. Torpedoes in the water is sometimes the expression used. You know that the money's coming. You can be, you know, you feel confident that you can spend money, you can hire people or not fire people, I guess, is the key right now. And so it helps to restore confidence. But the most important thing is it tells you the government would be willing to do more if necessary in terms of public spending to offset any further decline in private spending.
So there does appear to be a backstop in place, and the banks are counting on that, and that's helping them to feel more secure, and it is encouraging people to move into the economy. But, Andrea, the politics of this stimulus package are kind of interesting in the sense that the administration has created an argument for Republicans to actually resist some of this spending. Explain.
Well, you know, I mean, the Republicans have been resisting it really on political grounds. And as a matter of fact, yesterday in Louisiana, the legislature was unable to override Governor Jindal's saying that he was going to reject the unemployment money in that state.
Remind us exactly how that works. It's stimulus money that goes to what?
Well, it both increases the amount of the benefits by $25 a week, and also it extends it out over time. And, you know, last week, as you know, I was in North Carolina, and I was talking to workers who said very directly that unemployment extension was keeping people in the construction industry sort of afloat, you know, and alive and spending and you know, part of the economy until what they hope are jobs that are created. So, but you know what the Republicans have done is sort of, in many cases, just sort of reacted to all kinds of spending, reacted to, you know, this notion of the country going into debt. I mean, I think what their reckoning is going to be is, you know, in sort of in 3 more years from now, if the economy, you know, is in fact gearing up, you know, their reckoning is going to have to be, you know, were they on the right side of opposing it?
Right.
So far, polls suggest that they are not.
Right.
That, you know, most of the American people are both sort of grateful for the things they have gotten, like increased unemployment, the tax cuts, you know, what they are hoping will come. But you know, I have a question for Simon Johnson. I'm wondering, the 150,000 jobs created or saved, the 600,000 coming, still trying to, you know, I've come through the administration's reports. They had 2 reports out on this week, and I can't figure out where those jobs are coming in. And I'm wondering if you can help us figure that out.
I think that's a tough one. You know, the big issue is the indirect effect. So it's the fact that somebody doesn't lose a job and then they go out and they spend money in the coffee shop or they buy clothes that they wouldn't have bought. And that's very complicated to figure out. And, of course, it's the confidence effect. So the fact that it's not just banks, but much more broadly financial markets, not just in the United States, but also globally, have been reassured by this. So there's a lot of people who haven't lost their jobs. I completely agree that the math around the precise job saved is fuzzy and very much open to criticism. But the big picture is the overall financial situation is stabilizing.
Well, we should remind people that retail sales were down. Foreclosures hit a record. And that was announced this week. So there are some pretty rough waters out there. You talk about an intense crisis on the economics blog, Simon Johnson, and I just want to let people know that my wife has already IM'd me to say that I should stop talking about being smart because she knows differently. Simon, please explain.
Well, I think the bigger picture is, of course, that we're in a very nasty recession. So even if we have turned the corner on the crisis and the panic phase, we're looking at the worst recession almost certainly since World War II. Unemployment getting up to 10%, could go up to 11%. And it's going to be a struggle to recover because, in part, I think the banks have not been handled particularly well. And there's lots of other issues that are still coming at us. So I don't at all want to play down the problems, and I do think doing a further fiscal stimulus on top of what we've already done would be premature. The extra bang for the buck you get after you've restored confidence from this kind of fiscal spending is pretty small. So, you know, let's be honest, there's a long haul ahead of us.
Well, the IMF says specifically that a stimulus package works in the beginning, but as you proceed and begin to turn around, then the money is absolutely wasted. Is that what you're saying?
Not wasted, but it gives you it shortens the recession a little bit. If you do throw a lot of money at the problem, maybe you can shorten the recession by 1 or 2 quarters, according to their estimates. But, of course, you also run up the debt, and that's what Andrew is mentioning people are already starting to worry about. And the U.S. starts out with a medium level of government debt, about 40% of GDP held by the private sector. It'll go up to 60 to 70%, which is not good. That's your future taxes, my future taxes.
But
as long as it doesn't go any further, I think we can live with that.
Right. I mean, that's the unsustainable debt point. Andrea, in 20 seconds, I'll give you the last word.
Well, I think one of the things is that there's still a lot of disappointment that this stimulus bill isn't doing more in terms of public works. Simon Johnson, is there anything that we need to say about that?
Fiscal spending happens slowly. That's always the problem with this kind of public policy. And that's why generally it's not a good idea. But at the moment, this measure implemented January, February of this year. It was very helpful because of the confidence effect.
All right. Simon Johnson writes for the economics blog at nytimes.com and takeaway correspondent Andrea Bernstein. What were you thinking asking an economist a question with 20 seconds to go? She, of course, is the director of our Shovel Watch project. Thanks to both of you. We want to remind people, in honor of commencement, we're going to be talking about a very memorable commencement speech that was actually never given. But we're turning the mic over to you all hour. We're looking for the best piece of advice you ever got.
Hi, Rich Melheim, calling from Minnesota. Hi to John Hockenberry. I know his dad. My advice for the graduates today is don't make a living, make a life.
This is Mark in Brooklyn. My advice to the graduating class of 2009 is move back home with your parents.
Your advice at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So if you watched 60 Minutes over the weekend, maybe you saw this piece by Laura Logan talking about probably the most sensitive and advanced aerial capability that the U.S. military has, those robot aerial drones. The 60 Minutes team got special access to the control site outside of Las Vegas.
When we can take 34 airplanes and we can have them airborne all the time and they can look at whatever we need them to look at, that's a huge capability. And so because of that, the enemy has to do things differently now. They have to hide more. They don't know when we're looking at them. They don't know where we are.
That's Colonel Chris Chambliss talking on 60 Minutes on Sunday. You could say the same about civilians who are increasingly the not the target, but the victims of some of those drone attacks in disputes with Taliban forces. But yesterday we learned from the LA Times that there is an unprecedented level of U.S. and Pakistani cooperation on the use of these sensitive aerial robot drone planes in combating the Taliban, possibly even in Pakistani territory. Joining us to help set this into some sort of context and to figure out if the story is even true, the administration denies it, Christine Fair, senior political scientist for the RAND Corporation. She joins us from the Washington area. Christine, thanks for being with us.
No, thank you for having me again.
First, Christine, do you believe this LA Times story that somehow the Pakistanis have some level of operational sharing or control over the aerial drones?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to say I believe it or disbelieve it because, there's no basis to have that view. But what I can say is that the drone discourse has really changed in the last year. Pakistanis have really moved from saying drones are universally bad to saying drones are actually potentially effective. Our problem is a sovereignty issue. Let us be there involved pulling the trigger. And when Kiani was here, he had actually asked for drones.
He's the military leader.
Chief of Army Staff, Kiani. So the discourse has really changed. Pakistanis who recognize that there's a terrorist threat there realize that these are really effective. But they need to find some way, particularly with the return of whatever you think of it, it is nonetheless a civilian government. They're much more vulnerable to public concerns. And so anything that can look as if it's accommodating Pakistani sovereignty demands while still allowing us to continue using this effective tool is a good move. So I'm inclined to believe that it is true.
All right. Well, I don't want to get too Tom Clancy here, and but I'm just wondering if this involves merely having someone in a Pakistani uniform in the room in the double-wide trailer, I guess, that these are controlled from out in Arizona, or does a Pakistani officer actually get to pick targets or pull a trigger?
Well, I mean, of course, pulling a trigger is actually, as you say, it's done remotely. It's like a video game. I suspect, we've got these border control centers, which right now are only, there's only one working. It's in Afghanistan. And you actually have Pakistani liaison officers. I think they're rank of a major. They're sort of looking at the overall intelligence picture of Afghanistan, Pakistan's border area. I mean, that might be a venue. I mean, obviously, since they haven't confirmed or disconfirmed this story, speculating about where Pakistani officers would be inserted into the chain of command. I don't want to go there. But I think the basic story probably is credible, that we're trying to find some way of accommodating Pakistan's legitimate sovereignty concerns while still finding some way of preserving a tool that's been very effective in eliminating the bad guys. Incidentally, the civilian casualties have actually gone down. They're not increasing. The last several months, these things are pretty much hitting the bad guys. The problem is, of course, that the Taliban can pretty much say whatever they want to say because no media can get into the area to report on it. So there's a lot of difficulty in winning the PR war when Pakistan, for legal reasons, basically going back to a colonial era law, only tribals are allowed in the tribal area, and this effectively keeps most of the journalists out.
Well, apparently, next year it will be the first time the Air Force orders more robot planes, unmanned planes, than actually manned planes. So the proliferation of drones is something we're definitely going to be looking forward to. I would suspect CNN may be even developing some for media. Who knows?
Well, there would be
some reporting.
Non-state actors have it, too. I mean, we think of drones as this complicated thing that takes billions of dollars. In fact, many non-state actors, terrorists, whatever you want to call them, have actually been using planes, you know, the model planes that enthusiasts like to use to conduct very similar operations. Hmm. So, you know,
and that's off-the-shelf technology.
That's totally off-the-shelf. I mean, little cameras that are stuck on there, and then you can deliver ordnance. So,
wow.
I mean, we have this idea that it's only the sophisticated Americans that have this outrageous technology, but the reality is anyone can stick a camera on a plane, and then do something bad with that information.
I mean, that's an outrageously disturbing but important point there. The military did say yesterday that for the first time, the Pentagon is providing Pakistan with a broad array of surveillance information collected by the American drones. What's to say, and this has happened in the past, that the sharing of sensitive intelligence and targeting with Pakistan doesn't simply result in, the settling of vendettas, blow up this target, and it turns out to be some Army staff officer's enemy in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, I don't think that's going to happen on the Pakistan side. First of all, I suspect there's going to be a lot of control about where they have control, to be honest with you. For example, I don't think the Pakistanis are going to be very cooperative in going after Mullah Omar or Jalaluddin Haqqani or his son Siraj or Hekmat Diar. These are fellows that the Pakistan Army views as assets. They support the Afghan Taliban, not the Pakistani Taliban, and they're not the same organization.
Oh, that's pretty fascinating. Christine Fair, thanks so much for all of that. She's the senior political scientist for the RAND Corporation, talking to us about the story in the LA Times that describes some new level of cooperation between the U.S. and Pakistan on the use of robot drone airplanes over the Afghan-Pakistan theater. And then you got this idea that non-state actors are using little toy planes with robot cameras on them. Did you hear that, Femi?
Did.
Pretty interesting stuff. Femi Oke has now, of course, the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Starting overseas in Sri Lanka, at least 2,000 ethnic Tamil civilians waded across the lagoon today to break out of the war zone. That's according to the Associated Press. And this comes as both sides continue to battle despite the United States calling for a ceasefire. On Capitol Hill, President Obama said that he would try to block the release of some 40 photographs of prisoner abuse by U.S. soldiers. He said the photos would inflame anti-American sentiments and put U.S. troops in danger. And today, the House takes up to a $97 billion bill to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan through September. That's almost $12 billion more than the White House asked for. And by congressional calculations, it would push the cost of the wars to almost $1 trillion. Both North Carolina and Wisconsin passed legislation to ban smoking in restaurants and bars yesterday. 22 states and the District of Columbia have already passed similar legislation. And that is a look at stories making news this morning.
North Carolina's tobacco country as well.
It certainly is.
Must have been a politically sensitive one.
That was a tough one.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
To Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. In honor of all the commencement exercises taking place around the country, we're looking for advice for the class of 2009.
My name is Dr. Lucille Pilling. I graduated from University of Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health in 1992. The commencement speaker was Dr. Engels, the former Surgeon General. She began her speech as I was sitting between my two teenage sons with, "We have got to stop young men from donating their sperm and becoming responsible."
Any advice you have, 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org. We'll talk about commencement speeches of memory a little bit later on in the program. So Barack Obama is so popular that even car dealers and car advertisers are using some of his slogans.
When people ask, can we drive away in the luxury of a Chrysler 300C for under $50,000, I say, yes, we can. Or how about this legendary Jeep Cherokee for less than $38,000? I say, yes, we can. When people ask, can we buy a Dodge Nitro with 20-inch rims for under $35,000? I say, yes, we can. If you want change, see your Chrysler Jeep Dodge dealer today.
Well, if imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, they're going to need a lot of flattery when car dealers meet with the Obama administration in Washington this week, responding to cutbacks at GM and Chrysler. It looks like we're going to know exactly how many dealerships may close by the end of the week. Chrysler is going to tell us today. GM will do the same tomorrow. John McElhaney is a GM Toyota dealer from Clinton, Iowa. He's meeting with President Obama's auto task force later today to plead the case for some sort of assistance for national automobile dealers around the country who are facing closures. John, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome, John. Happy to be here.
Now, you're a salesman, right?
Yes, I'm an auto dealer, and I think by definition that makes me a salesman. I've been doing this for about 35 years, and my family's been in the auto business in Iowa for 95 years. So.
Wow. Well, I am totally sympathetic with your plight and the plight of dealers around the country, but the oldest rule in the sales game is if your product doesn't sell, you got to move on to another product. Is that what you're dealing with here?
Well, not necessarily, John. You know, the reality is in the domestic market, particularly GM and Chrysler, there are too many dealers for the available market. We don't question that. After World War II, there were 50,000 new car dealers in this country. Today, even with population increase, there's only 19,000. So attrition is happening fairly rapidly, especially with the financial challenges in today's market. But our concern is that what the task force has orchestrated with GM and Chrysler is just a little too radical, a little too fast, and the cuts may be a little too deep. And I think there'll be some negative implications for the whole industry when that occurs. We're just trying to slow the process down a little bit.
Well, the numbers are pretty alarming. I mean, you got 2,600 dealerships that might be closed. That's like 40% of GM's dealerships, 1,000 Chrysler dealerships, and it only has 3,200 around the country. What can the Obama administration do to dull the pain here?
Well, we're not asking for money, which I think is a refreshing change for a lot of the groups coming to Washington. We're not asking for financial assistance directly to dealers. We're strictly asking, and we've had a good dialogue with the task force on this, but we're trying to explain that by cutting the manufacturers outsource all the cost of the sales and service retail part of the business to dealers. We're independent business people. We pay for the vehicles the day they're shipped from the assembly plants. So it costs, for example, GM has said, their group vice president of sales has said, whether they have 6,000 dealers or 3,000 dealers, doesn't make any difference in their cost structure. So the end result by doing this too abruptly, we're going to put 187,000 dealership employees out of work over the next few weeks or months of these dealerships that are suggested to be closed. That's more people than Chrysler and General Motors employ in this country in total. And if that's not going to produce any real short-term gain for the manufacturers, it just doesn't seem to make any sense.
Is there a certain amount of bitterness between dealers and manufacturers who you would think would have had maybe a warmer relationship over, in your case, 95 years?
Well, you know, we're partners. We need them, and they need us. I'd like to think we're the only customer that the manufacturers have. They get 90% of their revenue for us. And, of course, we have agreements that, you know, require us to do certain things. So I think over the long haul, it's been a decent relationship. But, you know, the manufacturer's looking out for their own interest, and I think they might be using this opportunity of potential bankruptcy, you know, to maybe accomplish some things that they wouldn't be able to do outside of bankruptcy.
Well, those are some tough words. If these 187,000 jobs that are calculated from the 3,600 dealership closings actually are lost, visually, is that going to change the landscape in the United States? I mean, I remember coming up to the interstate exits in cities in the Midwest and seeing all the dealerships lined up, the big tall signs, these parking lots lit up even at night. Is that all going to go dark?
Well, you know, it won't all go dark, but we're talking 42% of the General Motors dealer network and about 30% of the Chrysler dealer network. And, you know, the average dealer has about $10 or $11 million invested. So collectively, that's $233 billion investment, and we're talking about maybe 15 or 20% of that going away. We're going to have empty dealership, single-purpose facilities, commercial real estate is going to hit the market all over the country, because when a dealer closes, one of these GM or Chrysler dealers, there's not going to be another dealer come in behind them, a Honda or Toyota dealer. That's not their model. They're not looking to expand their dealer network. So
and it's not like they're building malls. Empty. They're not building malls. The big mall company in the U.S. went bankrupt last month.
Right.
So these are some empty parking lots we're going to be looking at.
That's right. And that means a lot of lost sales tax revenue for these dealers that close, for states and municipalities, lost property taxes, employment taxes. So it, as I said, John, we're realistic to understand what's happening. And dealers, you know, we're independent business people. If we can't sell enough vehicles, if we can't, don't have enough capital, if we don't provide our customers with a good experience, you know, then we're going to go out of business. And that's
right.
Happening. GM's losing 60 to 70 dealers a month at this pace right now, just without any artificial actions to accelerate that.
Well, John McElhenney, thanks for being with us, and good luck on your meetings in Washington. John McElhenney is a GM Toyota dealer in Iowa and the chairman of the National Association of Automotive Dealers. He'll be meeting with the Obama administration later today. Femi Okeh is here now with the headlines.
Thank you very much. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Just getting some news in from the Labor Department. Unemployment claims were up more than expected last week due to auto layoffs. 637,000 people filed new applications for unemployment benefits last week. The president holds a town hall meeting in New Mexico today with people who've written to the White House about their frustrations with credit card companies. The president is pushing Congress to pass legislation that ends hidden fees and retroactive rate hikes. Cash-strapped California may have to sell off an L.A. Coliseum, state fairgrounds and a prison to deal with budget shortfalls. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger included plans to sell some $600 million in state property in his revised budget proposal to be released today. And that's a quick look at headlines making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We cover Washington a lot on this program. And if you want to follow what's going on in Washington, you couldn't do better than Todd Zwillick. Todd joins us now because we may get our first look at the first serious legislative attempt to deal with climate change today. The Congressman Henry Waxman of California and Edward Markey of Massachusetts, both Democrats, may unveil their bill to deal with climate change. Complicated piece of legislation. And Todd, the knives are out.
Yes, they are. John, you've heard of cap and trade?
Oh, yeah.
Well, listen to this.
Cap and trade is dead. I mean, it's dead. It's just that they got to get the coroner to conduct the autopsy and make it official. They are dreaming if they think they're going to get a cap and trade bill through the Congress and to the president's desk. I don't think they can get it out of committee.
Sounds like they don't even need the coroner. It's, who's speaking there?
Texas Republican Joe Barton, senior Republican on the Energy and Commerce Committee. Now, Henry Waxman is chairman of that committee, and that's the committee that, starting on Monday, is going to be processing the big climate change cap-and-trade bill. It has lots of aspects, but Henry Waxman has had to make a lot of concessions, not to Republicans. They're uniformly opposed. You heard Joe Barton there. His Sure. position is clear, and he's got all his Republicans with him. They've made a lot of concessions to get Democrats on board with this bill. They've already watered it down a little bit, watered it down from the perspective of the environmental community anyway, but it certainly hasn't gone far enough for the likes of Joe Barton.
Let's just help people on the cap and trade. That, of course, is the carbon market, the paying for the emissions of carbon to create a market that's going to penalize people for using carbon and create a set of incentives for people to use less carbon, emit less carbon. The Republicans have cast this as an energy tax, right?
They've cast it as an energy tax and as an economic war on the Midwest. And that was trying to target Midwestern Democrats from industrial states, places that make steel, places that make cars, places that dig coal, because all of these industries will be affected when the price of carbon goes up. So lots of concessions have been made. Industries that are so-called trade sensitive, that might lose market share to foreign competitors when their prices go up, they're getting giveaways under this bill. So when carbon is capped and then traded, the trade generates revenue. And the big debate in Congress right now is, where does the money go? Does it go to ratepayers, people like you and me when our electric bills go up? Does it go to the utilities? Does it go to industry? Well, industry gets 15% of the money. The autos get some of the money. Refineries are going to get some of the money. Us ratepayers get some of the money on our electric bills. But there are even – that's to mollify, to satisfy those Midwestern, sometimes moderate, sometimes conservative Democrats. They're slowly starting to come on board. But for every percentage point that you give them, you've got the liberal Democrats who represent a lot of low-income folks. They're getting upset because they thought that more of the percentage was going into the pockets of low-income people, not only to pay their electric bills, but to pay increasing cost of fertilizer, food, everything else that's likely to go up a little bit, or maybe even more than a little bit, once this bill is enacted.
Well, Todd, it sounds like the Democrats are running scared on the sort of tax idea, and that's what some of these amendments and changes are about. And is this the death by a thousand cuts? Is there a long way to go from today?
There's a long way to go. Republicans are promising hundreds, literally hundreds of amendments next week. They're promising deleterious tactics. They may make the clerks read this bill, 600 pages long. They're going to try to kill cap and trade. They're going to try to make it very, very, very difficult even to get out of the gates here.
If you want to follow what's going on in Washington, you couldn't do better than to sign up for Todd Zwillich's Twitter feed. You can find it at thetakeaway.org. Thanks, Todd.
My pleasure.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We'll graduate those graduates in a moment, but first, let's get some headlines from Femi Oke.
Good morning. It's almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Severe weather continues to cause problems in the Midwest. Injuries caused by tornadoes have left at least three people dead. Marla Murphy from Kurtzville, Missouri, was terrified by the tornado she saw.
Just a horrible noise. I don't know. It wasn't a train. You know, they always say a train, but maybe I was just screaming too loud myself.
High winds across central Indiana have left thousands without power. The producer price index from last month is now out. It's a measure of the average price for a fixed basket of goods received by producers. It rose by 0.3%, and analysts says that it reflects a big surge in food costs. The Obama administration is expected to announce additions to its mortgage plan today. New measures offer more assistance for homeowners, and borrowers may be able to avoid foreclosure by selling their properties or returning them to the lender. And that is a look at some stories making headlines this morning, John.
Thanks, Femi.
What are you going to do now?
I meant with your future.
Your life.
Well, that's a little hard to say.
I just want to say one word to you. Plastics.
I don't want to sell anything, buy anything, or process anything as a career. I don't want to sell anything bought or processed, or buy anything sold or processed. or process anything so bought.
But the question remains, what are we going to do now? Fellow graduates, the answer is simple. I don't know.
Pomp in these circumstances for the grads of 2009. The next chapter in our series is with someone who wrote what may be a pretty famous commencement speech, but never actually gave it. Chicago Tribune columnist Mary Schmeek wrote a column for the paper back in 1997. Advice Like Youth, Probably Just Wasted on the Young was the newspapery title. But you probably remember that column as the Wear Sunscreen speech that, through the anarchy of the internet, went viral and was rumored at one point to be a masterpiece written by author Kurt Vonnegut for an MIT commencement speech. It was even immortalized in a hit, somewhat dubiously successful 1999 song.
Wear sunscreen.
Now in 2009, we're going to take another look at this commencement speech and this phenomenon from back in 1997. Mary Schmeek, author of that speech, column, song, joins us from Chicago. Mary, I know you've probably answered this a million times, but what was it about this particular column that really got to something that was going on back in 97?
You know, I've wondered about that a fair amount in my life because it does seem to have this long, if not immortal, in your words, life. I think it was a combination of things. One, it's much shorter than a real graduation speech is, so people could actually absorb what was being said. It was early in the days of the internet, and so the fact that it went around the internet misidentified under a very famous name meant that it became representative of just the strangeness, the spookiness, the unreliability of the internet.
And also this quality of found wisdom. Here's the talisman, the stone tablet, uncovered in the cave.
Right. You know, and I like to think that maybe there's actually something useful in there that people were responding to. But it is a thing of its moment. I'm not sure that if it went around today on the internet that it would have the same kind of effect.
You know, the quality that struck me, I remember covering this story and, you know, following it like everyone did. You know, there wasn't a lot you could control in 1997. I mean, you could say the same thing about today. But, you know, let's just face it. We can probably remember the sunscreen. There was a certain tangibility and urgency about it that was a good combo for 1997. Is there something like that today?
Well, when your producer asked me that, the first thing that came to my mind was step away from your screens, your computer screens, your iPhone screens, your TV screens. Take out your earbuds.
Stop
texting. Look at the world around you.
Right? Stop texting.
Just engage the fully dimensional world.
Trust me on that.
Right.
Well, I can see it for a train operator or maybe a pilot, but, you know, it's the case that we live in separate worlds now. It's hard to give advice that's general because in some ways the internet, the very thing that made this speech so famous, has disconnected us in some ways in that our experiences aren't general. They aren't always recognizable.
I don't know that I agree with that. I mean, I think there are certain experiences that aren't shared, but I think the experience of being a 20-year-old, an 18-year-old, is not so different now than it was when, you know, back in ye olde days when you and I were 20. I mean, there are certain things that you're facing about your dreams, about your hopes, about relationships that are the same in any era. And I mean, one of the things that I actually do think about this little column/speech that I wrote back in 1997 is that the lines in it are very general. It's not like I was saying, don't use your Walkman. You know, it's not dated with brand names. It's saying, don't be reckless with other people's hearts. Don't put up with people who are reckless with yours. Dance. Floss.
Right.
These are timeless.
But it also delivers the message that wisdom is comprehensible. It's not something that you have to go, you know, harangue Yoda about.
Right. I'm always a little nervous when this is referred to as wisdom or even when it's referred to as advice. Way down at the end of it, I think I say something like advice is a form of nostalgia. It's a way of fishing the past from the disposal and brushing it off and selling it for more than it's worth. I mean, I think a lot of what's in that piece and what people connect to it's really not advice, it's consolation. It's the articulation of things that we already know, and we know them partly because we've experienced these things.
So the commencement speech is about an older person connecting with the universal experience of being 20, not offering advice necessarily.
Yeah. Of course, it's hard when you're middle-aged to fully connect with being 20. But I did, I remember so clearly the afternoon of writing that speech. I mean, the way it came to me was I was walking along Lake Michigan to work, and I saw this young woman who was sunbathing. It was oddly sunny in May in Chicago. And I just thought, oh, man, she should be wearing sunscreen, because I didn't when I was that age, and now the mirror tells it. And I just realized, you know, I had reached an age where I wanted to dispense advice to young people. But the more I thought about that, I thought, you know, it's really not just about trying to save them from the mistakes that I've made. I think writing this was in some way a way of just looking at my own mistakes and hoping to correct course for the second half.
You know, that's why I thought when I read it that there was no way a man could have written it. Because men at that age, you know, think they can connect with their 20s. And in fact, try to do it all the time in an almost infantile way. I think it's more a female sensibility to step away and to go, you know, I have some things to impart. Or at least that's more a classical female impulse, it seems to me.
Wait, so you don't think that men want to give advice?
They
want to
give advice.
40 and they want to give advice?
No, they're
know-it-alls.
Or
they just want to teach guys how to play ball.
Yeah,
right?
Or something like that. Or they're nostalgic about it. I remember when I was 20. They don't say, let me tell you what I've learned. You know, they don't want to. They want to say things like, I'm still young.
Right.
Seems to be. That's the male thing. Can I thank you for one thing, though, Mary?
Sure.
I know you must have had the chance to, like, endorse Coppertone sunscreen, and I really want to thank you personally for not doing that and ending up
Olay.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You were asked?
Uh-huh.
And you said no?
Yeah.
That's the best advice.
There were a lot of sunscreen-related advertising offers that came to me in that time that would have been extremely lucrative. And I just couldn't do it. It just made me sick. Of course, now I'm thinking, man, I could use that money. But it just, even though I don't think that this, you know, this piece is truly extraordinary, it felt that to the extent that it was authentic and it came out of a particular moment, genuine moment in my life, that to sell it to hawk sunscreen just seemed such bad karma.
You know, you are wise. I think, in fact,
poor,
you are wise. Yeah, poor and wise. Mary Schmeek, thanks so much for being on The Takeaway.
Thank you, John.
With all that good karma, Chicago Tribune columnist Mary Schmeek on her infamous sunscreen commencement column. We're looking for the best piece of advice you have for the grads of 2009.
The best advice I ever got was actually from the guy who gave me my motor vehicles test. And I asked him what would happen if when I do my parallel park, I hit the curb. And he told me it doesn't matter if you bump the curb, it's how you recover.
The class of 2009 needs your advice. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke to the graduating class at NYU yesterday.
Your passion and commitment is more needed than ever.
Did she tell the new grads what they wanted to hear? You can actually check out a video at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, you can follow the latest political news from Washington with Todd Zwillick on the Twitter feed. And if you want some political news on the stimulus, here's your takeaway.
The math around the precise job saved is fuzzy and very much open to criticism. But the big picture is the overall financial situation is stabilizing.
Fuzzy math from Simon Johnson. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Uh-oh, bad news from the big man.
Now, some graduating classes have marched into this stadium in easy times. Times of peace and stability. When we call on our graduates simply to keep things going and don't screw it up. Other classes have received their diplomas in times of trial and upheaval. It should be clear to you by now the category into which all of you fall.
Talking to graduates, the president delivers a warning of the cold, cruel, recessionary real world out there. Keep things going. Don't screw it up. Hey, that's our motto here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
And I screwed it up, of course. Good morning. It's Thursday, May 14th. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, the difficulties facing overworked Florida public defenders. It could be a national story. We also talk about the CDC's recent treatment recommendations for pregnant women who have H1N1, also known as swine flu. And how is the Obama administration and Congress going to resolve an argument over transparency? Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines. And in the headlines, new economic indicators just out are another reminder of what a big, tough world it is. There were 637,000 new unemployment claims last week. They're mainly due to layoffs in the auto industry. Meanwhile, the producer price index, that's the wholesale rate of inflation, rose 0.3% last month. That's more than expected, due mainly to a big jump in food costs. And some bad financial news from Asia. Japanese electronics giant Sony has announced an annual loss of $1 billion, its first net loss in 14 years. With more headlines, we've got Femi Okay.
Hello there, John. Good morning, all. In Sri Lanka, doctors and aides abandoned the only hospital in the country's war zone after repeated shelling. That news comes according to a health official in the war zone, and the government is continuing its military operation there, despite a call from President Obama to stop.
The government should give United Nations humanitarian teams access to the civilians who are trapped between the warring parties so that they can receive the immediate assistance necessary to save lives.
The president also asked the Tamil Tiger rebels to lay down their arms. 50,000 civilians are still trapped amongst the fighting. In the Middle East, Pope Benedict is in Nazareth celebrating a huge outdoor mass with thousands of Christians. The Pope's week-long trip through the Middle East is meant to improve relations between Christians and Muslims. A bill to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan through September comes up for a House vote today. The nearly $97 billion measure doesn't include the $80 million the administration requested to close Guantanamo Bay.
North Korea has set a trial date for those two American journalists accused of entering the country illegally. They'll be tried on June 4th for what North Korea describes as hostile acts. The journalists were working for Current TV. The Dow Jones Industrial Average opens today at 82.85 after a bad day yesterday. The S&P starts trading at 8.84. So it is a cold, cruel world out there. Any advice for the 2009 grads?
My advice to all graduates is cheer up. You have a whole life of misery ahead of you.
Thanks for sharing. Give us your graduation nuggets. Take the floor for a commencement speech on The Takeaway at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. We begin with a look at the criminal justice system at the local level. If you've ever been in a criminal courtroom, the people versus John Doe. At the people's table, there may be a team of prosecutors. At the defense table, there's certainly a client, probably not as well dressed as the lawyers, and there may be a public defender there if any lawyer represents that poor person or the John Doe in this particular case at all. The lack of parity between the resources available to poor defendants and prosecutors in local places all over the United States is maybe evident to the uninitiated hanging around a criminal courtroom, but it's playing out in a very, very strident political way in Miami-Dade County. And joining us to talk about it is Joshua Johnson, reporter and anchor with WLRN, Miami Herald News. And he's in Miami. Joshua, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John. Thank you for having me.
Maureen Dimino is an indigent defense counsel for the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. She worked in the Miami-Dade Public Defender's Office from 2004 to 2008. She joins us from Washington. Maureen, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John.
This is a very interesting situation, and I want to play some tape from Carlos Martinez, who's the Miami-Dade County's public defender. He's one of the Miami-Dade County's public defenders. And basically, you have public defenders who are overworked with limited resources, needing to turn away clients, but an appeals court yesterday taking their ability to turn down clients away, further stretching their resources. Here's Carlos Martinez.
Seeing what our attorneys are going through, because they feel that they cannot do a competent job, and they came here to carry out a mission, to carry out a mission of helping the poor. And when they see that they cannot do their job diligently and competently, it's heartbreaking. And as public defender, I have to fight for the clients, and I have to fight for my attorneys.
So, Joshua Johnson, is this a labor story, a kind of a workplace story by some overworked public defenders, or is this a story about the wheels of justice?
It's kind of a little bit of both. To read the decision, there's some discrepancy in terms of what the appeals court felt was the right way to go about doing this. Miami-Dade County's public defender's office felt that the way to do it was to go to a circuit judge and say, look, we are so overworked, we can't bear to take any more cases without essentially infringing on the constitutional rights of each person, because the Sixth Amendment guarantees you the right to defend to trial, and Florida's Constitution also guarantees it. And the judge initially agreed, but then once it went up to appeal, the appellate court said, well, we're not sure you've actually proven that these clients are actually being harmed on an individual level, and you shouldn't take the solution through the courts. You should take it through the legislature. So it seems like there's a disagreement as to where the problem is and how to fix it.
Maureen Dimino, in localities around the United States, the issue of economic parity between the resources available to public defenders and the resources available to prosecutors has been looked at. I'm wondering how difficult it is for a public defender to prove that because they're overworked or fatigued or have too many clients, they're actually denying due process to their clients on some basis.
Well, I think that's very true. I think they're overworked. I think the parity is a big problem between prosecutors and public defenders. And I think as the budgets continue to shrink throughout the nation, you're going to see more and more problems. Miami-Dade is representative of the nation. States are just failing to provide constitutional rights because they're forced to work with such tight budgets.
Now, that sounds correct, but I'm wondering how high the bar is if you have to go in and prove that it amounts to denial of due process for any individual client. How do you prove that, and how high is the bar set, Maureen?
Well, that's the problem. The bar is extremely high. If you look at Miami-Dade, their caseload numbers, we commissioned a report on looking at the misdemeanors throughout the nation called Minor Crimes, Massive Waste. Miami-Dade has 2,232 cases. The national standard is 400. How is it possible that they are able to provide competent counsel? It's impossible when you look at those numbers. Just looking at those numbers, you know that it's like the ER. They are unable to do what they need to do.
And the heroes on television don't play out in the same way in the real life. And James Dunn, who, Josh, I know you talked to, certainly reflects the issue of it's not really fun to be a public defender in Broward County, Florida. Listen.
I mean, our office is dying. I mean, it's struggling. It's dying. My friends leave. You know, we have goodbye parties, you know, with so much frequency. It's disheartening.
Joshua, where did you run into Mr. Dunn?
I met him at a junkyard, actually. He is a young man who is a very idealistic attorney, and he was out at the junkyard to try to find parts for his car because he doesn't make enough money to take it to a shop. Thankfully, he's from Michigan, so he knows a thing or two about automotives, and so we were out there looking for a bearing to replace a wobble in his rear right wheel.
Well, Josh, he wasn't happy about it, that's for sure.
The junkyard, it's humbling. I mean, it does smell like urine out here. This is a humbling type of experience. You know, there's some amount of dignity in moving on with whatever means you have. And for me, it's temporary. It really is. If I want to leave here, leave this job, I can.
You know, Mr. Dunn there is making the argument, you know, all litigators get hazed in the public defender's office. It's a stepping stone to a law firm that's a different kind of job. Why shouldn't he get hazed just like anyone else?
Well, that's the problem is there's really no threshold for defining the hazing. I mean, depending on who you ask, and even if you look at the original judgment where the public defenders temporarily almost got permission to reroute cases, they list several different standards. It's not like being a truck driver, where if you're a truck driver, you can say the federal law requires that I drive no more than 11 hours in a 14-hour shift. That's written down. You can point to the regulation. If you're a lawyer, there's no law that says how much is too much. So if you're a public defender screaming, I have 100 cases, I have 200 cases, I'm overworked, help, 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 it's very easy legally to look back and say, oh yeah, you're overworked, prove it. And they can't.
Politically, Maureen, is the same till that provides the money for the public defender supplied by the people who run on law and order, campaign slogans to get elected to the legislature, or in some cases is even the budget for the public defenders under the prosecutor's office?
Yes, it depends on the jurisdiction, but that's very true in many jurisdictions where convictions fund the criminal justice process.
So the revenue from convictions and fines is what pays for the lawyers for the defendants?
In many jurisdictions, yes.
So there's no incentive to provide parity?
That is something that we have studied and we would like to bring more to the forefront, because that is, in fact, a big problem in the criminal justice system. It's inherently biased.
Go ahead, Josh.
I'm not sure I completely agree with that in the long run sense. Granted, the convictions do provide funding for the offices, but in two senses, I don't know, I fully agree. One, if you talk to state attorneys, including in Miami-Dade and Broward, they're going through a lot of budget cuts as well. Not to the same extent that public defenders are, and granted, they're not as beleaguered, but throughout all sides of the criminal justice process, Florida, at least, has really struggled to make this work. The second thing is that if you talk to Carlos Martinez, he is convinced that if there isn't enough of a system of defense to balance out prosecution, some of these cases are going to get overturned for lack of proper counsel.
That's
going to cost more on the back end to pay for settlements and fixing what we should have done properly the first time than to just do it right the first time.
Although I'm wondering, Josh, if that argument gets obliterated by a sense that, in these troubled times, nobody has sympathy for defendants who are arrested for charges like battery, marijuana possession, or grand theft auto. Is that how it plays out politically?
I tend to think so. I mean, those are exactly the cases that were going to be rerouted if this had gone through and this had held up an appeal. Big cases like murders and child rape, that would have still fallen in the public defender's office. But even beyond that, when there is already a system for private attorneys, if they want to take on these cases from the public defender voluntarily, they can do it. And they can get paid by the state of Florida. But what they would get paid, it's like $10,000 or $15,000 to take on a murder defendant. It's peanuts. It's pennies. There's no financial incentive for anyone on any side of the issue to really dive in and help these folks. So you're kind of in a catch-22 no matter what side you're on.
Okay, so the next act here is an appeal. Describe how that's going to work, and then I want to get the last word from Maureen.
The appeal is going to go, hopefully, to the Florida Supreme Court. They already kicked the appeal back once. The first time the Florida Supreme Court said they didn't have jurisdiction and sent it back to the Third District Court of Appeals. Beyond that, it probably is going to fall to the legislature to do something. But considering how bad the budget was, I mean, we had to extend our legislative session for a week to balance the budget this time. So I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
Maureen Dimino, any chance that the Miami case will make this more of a national story?
Absolutely. And I think really the focus should be on, at a time of economic crunch, we need policies and laws that pay off, not add up.
All right.
And the question is, we really need to evaluate these petty crimes we're prosecuting and fund the cases that are very serious.
Good advice. Maureen Dimino, indigent defense counsel for the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. She spoke to us from Washington. And Joshua Johnson, reporter and anchor with WLRN. Great work. Miami Herald News, located in Miami. Great story out of Miami with national implications.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Maybe we all want to be young again, but who envies the predicament of the class of 2009? They need your advice.
I'm giving advice to graduates who are planning on getting married in these tough economic times. Remember, two can live as cheaply as one if one of you doesn't eat.
Practical advice from our listeners, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. So 2 weeks ago, you probably remember we were smack dab in the middle of that media frenzy covering H1N1, commonly known as the swine flu, the epidemic, of course, that apparently began in Mexico. While the media may have all moved on, the same can't be said for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC said this week that pregnant women should be treated with Tamiflu, even though the drug isn't normally recommended for pregnancy because of the risks of the flu in pregnant women. One of the three H1N1-related deaths in the U.S. was a pregnant woman in Texas. So to explain some of the details and give us some context for these new precautions is Tim Uecke, a medical epidemiologist at the CDC, who joins us from Atlanta. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And is it Dr. Tim or just Tim?
Dr. Tim is fine.
All right, great. First of all, what would you say to a pregnant woman? And I'm sure many have like come up to you on the street. It must be hard for you to get through a dinner party. And says, you know, what should I do here?
Well, the first thing is there's no cause for panic. But what we have seen is this epidemic is spreading in the U.S. It's spreading worldwide. It's not over by any means. And we've seen a lot of sick people. Most people are having, relatively mild to moderate illness that does not require hospitalization, self-limited influenza-like illness, sometimes with diarrhea and vomiting. But we have seen a number of cases among pregnant women, and we have seen some pregnant women that are hospitalized. And as you mentioned, one has died. And we're trying to get the word out. The best thing is to avoid people who are sick. Stay away from people that appear to be coughing. Certain preventive measures. If there are women who are pregnant who have fever and acute respiratory symptoms, so cough, sore throat, so forth, runny nose, muscle aches, those people, those women should seek medical attention right away. There are tests available to detect this new virus infection, and there are antiviral medications. And as you mentioned, oseltamivir or Tamiflu can be prescribed. And what we're recommending at CDC is that pregnant women seek medical care early and that they should be treated if it's thought that they have symptoms compatible with this new swine H1N1 virus infection.
All right, so you've got the pregnancy, you know, which is 9 months, 36 weeks. Is this more of an issue in early term or late term, or does it not make a difference? It's equally an issue.
That's a great question. We really don't know. You know, this is, again, a new infection. We're just learning a lot every day. I think pregnant women of any gestation, what we've seen is just, you know, early data. Some of the more severe cases are in women who are in the third trimester. But certainly women of any trimester that appear to have, you know, they're sick acutely with fever, respiratory symptoms should seek medical care. We know that in past influenza pandemics of the 20th century, there were higher death rates in pregnant women, and there were other complications associated with this in pregnant women. We know during seasonal influenza epidemics, pregnant women are at greater risk for hospitalizations, complications. But, you know, again, this is a new virus infection. We have observed a number of pregnant women who have confirmed infections and some severe and fatal outcomes, as I mentioned. And so we want to get the word out, really, both to the to pregnant women as well as to the OBGYN community.
Now, how does this have an impact on the fetus? Does the fetus actually get the flu, or is it more about a weakness in the mother affecting the baby and affecting the overall health?
Well, that's a great question. We really don't know that much right now. Certainly, any time a pregnant woman develops a fever, that certainly puts the developing fetus at risk. So in general, infections are, you know, you want to really avoid these in a pregnant woman. We don't know about the risks of, for example, a pregnant woman who gets infected with this new virus about the risks of transference to the fetus. For example, we know that in other influenza viruses, something that is not a human virus, but an avian influenza virus, for example, the H5N1 virus, that has caused very severe disease and fatal outcomes. There have been pregnant women infected, and there's at least one case in which it appeared that the virus was in the bloodstream and had infected the developing fetus through the placenta. But we don't know whether this virus can get in the bloodstream. It potentially could in a very, very severely, critically ill pregnant woman, and therefore there could be potential. Again, we don't have data on this. It's something that we'd like to look at. It's a brand-new infection, so we don't know.
And finally, you know, 2 weeks ago, the media was all over this. What do you say to someone that really doesn't know the difference between whether they should be alarmed or whether they've been watching, a reality show like The Amazing Virus with, Sanjay Gupta all over the world? What is the hysteria versus the actual medical risk here?
Well, there's no cause for panic. There's definitely not. But I think that all the interest has died down, but this virus has not gone away. It's a new virus. It appears that most people are highly susceptible. We have seen a lot of outbreaks. As you know, in New York City, there have been school outbreaks. There have been university outbreaks in other states. Yep. There have been, a lot of people who have been infected in the U.S. But again, this is a global problem. There's, I believe, more than there's 33 countries to date that have reported more than almost 6,500 confirmed cases.
Which means we need to keep watching the numbers, and we'll probably be dealing with this again when fall flu season begins. Tim Uecke, medical epidemiologist for the CDC, thank you for being with us. And do something about that cough, won't you, Tim? Jimmy Okay is here with the headlines.
Okay, thanks a lot. Almost 29 minutes past the hour. Good morning, everybody. Pope Benedict was greeted by thousands of pilgrims today while celebrating Mass in Nazareth.
Benedetto, benvenuto a Nazareth.
The Pope urged Christians and Muslims to end tensions there. After the Mass, the Pope met with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees is in Pakistan today, visiting refugee camps. He said that Pakistan needs massive international aid to stop a tragedy from happening as it struggles to deal with more than 800,000 refugees. In the United States, unemployment claims were up more than expected last week due to auto layoffs. The Labor Department reports 637,000 people filed for new applications for unemployment benefits last week. And that's a look at your news headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm John Huckleberry. Is there any pomp in these circumstances for the class of 2009? They need your advice.
This is Sean from Charleston, South Carolina. I'd like to tell today's graduates to not let Obama and his cronies lead them down the path of destructive socialism.
Any advice, we can use it, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We're choosing unity over division and sending a powerful message that change is coming to America.
That is America's first African-American president, Barack Obama, and he certainly talks a big game as far as change is concerned. But consider this. The former University of Chicago constitutional law professor had to give up his teaching job to take his new jobs in politics, ultimately ending up in the White House. But Geraldine Sam, first grade teacher in Lamarck, Texas, outside of Galveston, and the mayor-elect of the town of Lamarck, you're still a teacher, right, Geraldine?
That's correct.
So you're going to do your teaching job and be mayor of Lamarck, right?
Well, I think I'll be teacher during the day and mayor in the evening time, or if there's anything that's going on during the daytime. My school district has given me the opportunity to address any issues dealing with the city.
Now, you are the first African-American woman mayor in the history of Lamarck, which is no mean feat, correct?
That's correct, and also the first African-American female in all of Galveston County. There has never been a mayor, African-American female in Galveston County, so that's awesome.
So you can't just give speeches about change. You actually have to get things done there in City Hall, correct?
That's correct. That's correct. That's what we wanted, a new vision for change, and a new vision has come to the city of Lamarck.
Now, listen to some of your first grade teachers who actually are assessing the new job that you have. And I have to say, the early reports sound pretty good.
My name is Pisha, and I want to be a mayor like Ms. Sam. And she's a great mayor and a teacher.
Hello, my name is Janae, and I'm in the Sam class. And I think she's going to be a good mayor. Thank you.
Well, Geraldine and Sam, they're not voters. They're first graders, but they're giving you good marks.
Oh, yes. Actually, my students wanted to vote for me, and they were a little bit upset that they couldn't vote for me. And they kept telling their parents, well, no, she's the president of Lamarck. And I said, no, Miss Sam is the mayor, you know, of Lamarck. And so we had a history lesson on what a mayor actually does.
Well, I want to talk to you about that in just a moment. How long have you been a first grade teacher?
I've been teaching school for 24 years.
24 years. And does first grade teaching prepare you for dealing with the preschoolers in City Hall?
Absolutely. I think that you have to, first of all, be able to come in and work with them and just let them know that, you know, if they don't do what I'm asking them to do, I may have to place them in time out.
So how's time out going to work? Tell me what's on your agenda. What needs to happen in Lamarck in your first 100 days?
Well, what we're looking at is we're going to collaborate with the police department and the community to prevent crime. We're going to look at neighborhood revitalization and encourage our neighbors to take pride in their neighborhoods. And we're going to apply for community development block grants. And we're going to look and invest in our youth and give them something to do during the summertime. We're working with Transit Connect for our first bus system coming through Lamarck. Lamarck has never had a bus system, and we're working with them. We're going to partner with our school district in Lamarck to make sure that Lamarck, the city of Lamarck, and our school district work together to make our city the best that it can be.
Now, that's nine things in your first 100 days, by my count there.
That's
a lot of stuff. Now, on the bus system, you know, you may be able to call up Obama directly and get some of that stimulus money down there in Lamarck. Any plans to do that?
Well, absolutely. We're going to make sure that we accept any stimulus money from President Obama, any money that our city can use. We're going to go after that money. We're needing it down here in Lamarck.
Well, how do you get it? Do you even know who to call?
Oh, absolutely. Our city manager will be doing most of that work, and also our economic development director will be on that case with grants and any other money that we're needing.
Now, do you think it's harder to make change in a place like Lamarck, which, you know, is a conservative part of Texas? It's, you know, they do things the way they do them, and they haven't been doing a lot of changing down there. Or is it easier, maybe if you're Barack Obama, to, you know, address the nation, a more diverse constituency?
Well, I think that Lamarck was ready for a change, and it has been difficult in the past, but I think that on this day, I think that the people of Lamarck decided that enough is enough, and that we can't keep doing the same things over and over again and expecting a different result. I think someone called that insanity. And so here in Lamarck, we're going to work together to make the difference and the change.
All right. Well, Mayor Sam, we want to follow you during your first 100 days. Will you let us do that here at the Takeaway?
Oh, yes, please. And I will be sworn in on tonight at 6 o'clock. And it is just so phenomenal, all of the people in the community, people that have raised me, are just my baby. This is our Miss Sam, you know. So it's going to be wonderful. Please follow me. I'd love to have you do that.
Well, the enthusiasm is infectious, bubbling out of Geraldine Sam, 57 years old, mayor-elect of Lamarck, Texas, first African-American woman to be elected mayor in Galveston County on a platform of change. She's also a first-grade teacher there. Mayor Sam, we'll be checking in with you again. Femi OK has the headlines.
At 22 minutes to the top of the hour, the Obama administration is expected to announce additions to its mortgage plan today. The new measures would let homeowners avoid foreclosure by selling their properties or returning them to lenders. Also today, the president will hold a town hall meeting in New Mexico with people who've written to the White House about their frustrations with credit card companies. The president is pushing Congress to pass legislation that ends hidden fees and retroactive rate hikes. Pilot training, fatigue, and distractions may have been factors in the February crash of a commuter plane near Buffalo, New York. That's according to hearings for the National Transportation Safety Board. The board hears today from federal regulators on how they plan to deal with the problems. It's the last day of a three-day hearing into the crash that killed 50 people.
It's been amazing. Yeah. I mean, it's been a complete look under the hood at the NTSB, that's for sure.
And also how little the pilot was actually paid, which meant that he had to sleep somewhere he shouldn't have been sleeping. And so the saga goes on. I will continue to report on that story. The last repair mission for the Hubble telescope is underway, and you can follow the Atlantis shuttle crew on the NASA Twitter feed. This morning, NASA tweeted the wake-up music for the Atlantis crew.
Here we go.
Are you mocking me, Hockenberry?
No.
Stick Shifts and Safety Belts was dedicated to astronaut Drew Fusto. Drew and astronaut John Grunsfeld have just started a spacewalk. I know this because I just followed their Twitter feed. The Hubble Space Telescope's 15-year-old camera will be replaced, and the old camera will make a trek back to Earth and be on display at the Smithsonian. I can't wait for tomorrow's wake-up music.
What's the way it is on the shuttle report from Femi OK.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Aung San Suu Kyi, the human rights activist in Myanmar under house arrest, is now once again in the custody of Myanmar authorities. And it's because an American man, a reported Mormon who claims to be writing some sort of faith-based book, swam across a lake to her house as an intruder. Now, suddenly, the whole issue of Aung San Suu Kyi is in turmoil. And for more on this, I spoke with the BBC Asia analyst Jill McGivering earlier this morning. And I asked Jill to explain exactly what happened, because it seemed like a real mystery.
It does seem a very peculiar story, I have to say. It all seems to have happened about a week ago when this gentleman, John Yetor, his name is, from Missouri, apparently swam across the lake that leads towards the compound where Aung San Suu Kyi is normally based. Now, that's a mile swim. It's a long way. And we gather that he tried to go and visit her last year in a more conventional way, using the road route, presumably, but was turned away. This time, it seems he took matters into his own hands and swam. And we've got some pictures of him, actually. Apparently a picture he took of himself shortly before trying to do the swim, and also a picture of his feet in some rather strange homemade flippers. They're like sandals with big square bits on the front. And we gather he arrived. According to Aung San Suu Kyi's lawyers, he was uninvited, and Aung San Suu Kyi apparently tried very hard to persuade him to leave because he may have understood what consequences might be for her. He wouldn't leave. He said he was exhausted after the swim. And in the end, he was allowed to rest. He slept slept downstairs on the ground floor overnight. The following day, he went back and did the repeat swim, again, a mile across this enormous lake, and was picked up then by the authorities and taken into custody.
Now, this violates the details of Aung San Suu Kyi's house arrest. Explain how that works and that this has now become a pretext for her being in custody again.
Well, absolutely. I mean, in fact, she's just coming to the end of a six-year term under house arrest, and that would have come to an end on May the 27th. And there was a big debate about, well, what's going to happen next? Normally, 6 years is the absolute maximum, even under the law in Myanmar, to be able to keep someone in detention like that, and a quite severe detention. She has no communications with the outside world. She isn't allowed visitors. Sometimes when she's ill, she isn't allowed doctors. So it's really quite a draconian situation. And people were debating, well, are they going to have to let her go? Are they going to? What pretext could they find, perhaps, for extending the house arrest?
Well, of course, they can do anything. They can do anything they want in Myanmar, right?
Well, they can. That's right. It's a military government. But they are under quite a lot of pressure from the international community. They have to try to find ways of justifying what they do. And, of course, they are criticised a lot, both by their own internal people and also by the international community for human rights abuses. So they are aware of some of the consequences of their actions.
So
they have charged her, basically, with contravening the terms of her house arrest.
Right, because by she's having a house guest.
Exactly. Right. Having someone there that was unauthorised and was there for 2 days.
So I gather quite quickly that at the very least, the presence of this American man is utterly unwelcome.
Absolutely, and certainly it sounds from all the comments that are being made by the team that is close to her, including her lawyers, that they are furious. They described him as a fool. One of them said he was nutty. One of them basically has accused him of giving the military authorities the opportunity they wanted to put her in jail.
Oh, and he's certainly thrown a wrench into the status of Aung San Suu Kyi. My guest was BBC Asia analyst Jill McGivering, who earlier this morning spoke to us from London on the situation for the human rights activist as a result of an American intruder.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So let's give the class of 2009 some advice as it flies into the turbulence of this economy.
My name is Angela, and I'm calling from Detroit, Michigan. Sitting where I am, I know things can seem dark, but it's your fresh minds and fresh ideas that are going to breathe new life into the world.
Now that sounds like a commencement speech. Call us with yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Now Femi Okeh has the headlines.
At 12 minutes to the top of the hour, the American Civil Liberties Union says that they will fight for the release of about 40 photographs of prisoner abuse by U.S. soldiers. The president says that he doesn't want the photographs to be published because they could inflame anti-American sentiments and put U.S. troops in danger. The ACLU's Caroline Fredrickson disagrees.
I fear the publication of these photos may only have a chilling effect on future investigations of detainee abuse.
And that, of course, was the president. Caroline Fredrickson says that the photographs should be released because without seeing the evidence, people can actually direct their attention to the particular people in the photographs as opposed to just not liking Americans generally. Meanwhile, President Obama is telling government lawyers to try to block the court-ordered release of the photographs, and it's an abrupt reversal of his previous stand. Cash-strapped California may have to sell off an L.A. Coliseum, state fairgrounds and a prison to deal with budget shortfalls. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger included plans to sell some $600 million in state property in his revised budget proposal to be released today. And both North Carolina and Wisconsin passed legislation to ban smoking in restaurants and bars yesterday. 22 states and the District of Columbia have already passed similar legislation. And that is a look at some stories making headlines this morning. John.
Thank you, Femi. As Femi alluded to there in that story, this dispute between the administration and some lawyers on the release under the Freedom of Information Act of photos which show alleged abuse of detainees from Iraq and Afghanistan has caused a debate. That there was abuse in Iraq and Afghanistan is not in dispute, but the issue of transparency in the Obama administration is under debate now. Obama doesn't want to release the photos. Well, here to talk about what this move represents on a variety of levels, from the involvement of torture and the treatment of detainees that have emerged since President Obama took office, it's been an issue really since the inauguration, is Vicki Duvall, a government teacher at the U.S. Naval Academy. She's also the former general counsel of the Senate Intelligence Committee from 2001 and 2003, and she's a former assistant general counsel for the Central Intelligence Agency as well. Vicki Duvall, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Let's begin with this issue of transparency. Is there a legal standard for transparency, or is this making political nice here?
Well, I think there are a variety of legal standards that speak to the issue of transparency. There's no one standard. The Freedom of Information Act, for example, provides a legal basis for the general public and the media to ask our government questions and provide standards for when they must answer. There are other transparency type laws, for example, the one that I was discussing in my op-ed, having to do with when and how much and to whom in Congress the president, and it is the president's responsibility, has to give Congress about intelligence activities.
Well, let's talk about your op-ed here, because I think you raised an issue that occurred to me once it was clear that Nancy Pelosi seemed to have gotten briefed by the CIA about so-called enhanced interrogation techniques very early in the game when she was a part of the House Intelligence Committee. The circumstances of that briefing are the CIA comes in, claims they're going to talk about some very sensitive matters, classifies the material as part of the conditions of the briefing. And so Congress is officially notified, but they're also under orders not to tell anyone else in Congress. Is this a restraint of the separation of powers in the sense that, in theory, Congress can stop the administration from doing anything, but if it can't tell other lawmakers about it, there's really no way legislatively that Congress can move forward?
Well, exactly. Congress is an entity. It's made up of individuals, but they act as a unit. And if you set up a structure, which is set up in the law, but I think the law, although it could be improved, does anticipate that it would be a meaningful notification. But if you set up a system or use an approach that forces just a handful of members to be the custodian of this information on behalf of the whole Congress, you have essentially limited the ability of the Congress to act.
Now, there's no evidence that people like Jay Rockefeller, who apparently was briefed, Nancy Pelosi, there is some dispute about what she was told or what she knew. There's no evidence that any of these people, save perhaps one, raised an objection. But let's talk in theory about something that Congress might have been briefed on where the members of the committee said, this is outrageous. Forget it. We want you to stop this tomorrow. There's almost nothing Congress can do to actually put any wheels in motion, right?
Well, the law requires them to be, quote unquote, notified. And we can debate whether they were or are normally notified in an effective way or even in a lawful way. And you're right. I mean, it's a notification. It's not a mother may I. It's not a we're going to do this. Is this okay? That's not how the separation of powers works.
But isn't that implied by the Constitution?
Well, certainly. And it would go into play. They just can't object at that moment. I mean, they would have the power of persuasion to say, we are going to take action. We are going to cut off your funding. We are going to pass a law that says don't do this. And they can do all of those things or try to. But at the moment of the notification, you're right, that there's nothing they can do. The executive branch can move forward. But if the notification has been given broadly enough and effectively enough, and one of the issues here is that normally in a closed briefing, in a very small briefing such as these were, as far as we know, the members don't take notes. They're discouraged from taking any kind of notes. There probably is absolutely no record
right.
in the legislative branch about what these briefings involved. And the only record we will have is the one kept by the CIA briefers themselves. Mm. Not that I'm saying they wouldn't keep accurate records, but it's still unfortunate that, you know, when history looks back on this, we will only know what the executive branch says happened. We won't know what the legislators say happened. We'll never know.
Well, where do you think this is headed? Is new legislation going to be drafted that would create more of a process that you describe in your op-ed, or is this dispute over what Pelosi knew and when likely to result in an actual Supreme Court test of the restraint potential of classifying information in briefings?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's very hard to get cases up to the Supreme Court. You need to meet certain standards of case and controversy to move forward with that. So I would doubt that that would happen. I think that more likely the attention that this situation is getting and the fact that the Speaker and others have been put in a very difficult position of people saying what they knew and they don't have the same recollection of what they were told will result in a look again at these notification procedures, not just what the law says, but how the law has been followed or not followed. And I don't believe it's been followed.
Well, the irony here is that while the initiatives in Congress were originally argued to hold potential Bush officials accountable for some of these behaviors, it may end up, and then you write eloquently in your op-ed, that it's Congress that will be held accountable, what they knew, what they did, and what maybe they should be doing in the future, that will be more of a central issue.
Exactly. That is, I suppose, ironic. I think both angles of it will be looked at very closely. I know Senator Feinstein said yesterday that the chairman of the now chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, that she's going to look at all aspects of this, and I trust that she will. She's an excellent senator, and will look deeply into all of this. And then at the end of the day, they'll decide whether the laws are good enough and they just weren't followed, or whether they need to be at least clarified so that they will be followed in the future.
Well, you can find the op-ed from my guest, Vicki Duvall, who's a government teacher at the U.S. Naval Academy, on our website. It's also at nytimes.com. She's a former general counsel of the Senate Intelligence Committee and assistant general counsel for the CIA. Graduations this week, next week. Students are headed out into the world. Maybe they'd rather stay in school. The class of 2009 needs your advice.
My stepfather, at age of 73, did pull me aside and say, "Let me tell you the most important thing I ever learned." He said, "I didn't have to do it alone. That if I had realized I could depend on others and work with others earlier in life, I would have been a success much earlier."
Tell us your advice at our website, thetakeaway.org. Some details on a story we've been following this morning. Chrysler now says it wants to eliminate 789 dealerships as part of its restructuring process. That will definitely affect some of the people that we spoke with on the program this morning. If you missed anything, we are always on here at The Takeaway. You can take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. While you're there, you can also get the latest political news from Washington with our man on the Hill, Todd Zwillick. Get his Twitter feed at thetakeaway.org. And here is your takeaway for this hour.
All the interest has died down, but this virus has not gone away. It's a new virus. It appears that most people are highly susceptible.
That's right. He said most people are highly susceptible. That's Tim Uecki, medical epidemiologist for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.